Welcome to the third episode of the Best of Inside Medical Malpractice. At the conclusion of each episode, I have the privilege of asking our amazing guests to share insights on the most important aspects of medical malpractice that they think healthcare providers, lawyers, and the general public should be aware of. Their responses are as diverse as their perspectives, yet consistently intelligent, thought-provoking, and insightful. In this episode, we are honored to feature guests from both Canada and the United States, including a doctor, a mother who tragically lost her son due to medical error, and plaintiff lawyers, one who is a brand new mother. If you haven't had the opportunity to listen to the previous Best of episodes, they were immensely popular, and I highly recommend that you take the time to listen. We have carefully curated the most valuable pieces of advice from season two of Inside Medical Malpractice for this episode. I sincerely hope that you enjoy it, and I promise that you'll gain some valuable knowledge. First up in this episode, some insights shared by Dr. Daniel Ofri, internist at Bellevue Hospital in New York City, clinical professor of medicine at NYU, editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review, and author of the renowned book, What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. Dr. Ofri, who is a repeat guest on the podcast and one of the most popular of all time, provides some invaluable guidance. She emphasized specifically the importance of the doctor-patient relationship in healthcare. And because we are all consumers of healthcare, her advice holds immense importance for everyone. According to Dr. Ofri, the stronger the doctor-patient relationship is, the less likely it is to result in legal action. What advice do you have for patients in this conversation to increase their power or gain more control over the communication with their care providers?
So I suggest that when you come into an encounter, be it an outpatient visit or inpatient doctors on rounds, you might want to think in advance, what are the three things that are most important for you right now? And I know sometimes patients will come in with this list of 50 questions, and I always remind them that I understand that, but if you do 50 things, you'll be superficial, and we can't do them all. So pick the three most important things, and you can let the doctor or nurse know in advance, here are the three things I want to make sure we get to. And now, of course, the doctor or nurse may have three other things, and you have to, you know, recognize that and let them also, because their things may be equally important, although different. And then at the end of the encounter, if you haven't gotten to those three things, it's okay to say, hey, remember, there were these three things I wanted to get to. We got to two, but we missed the one about XYZ. And so really sort of insist on that. And it's the same with sort of bringing in, you can bring in, you know, collateral information, previous records, the family. But again, if you walk in, I've had patients walk in with a 2-foot stack of records and pop, I say, here, doc, just read that, as though I have a spare 8 hours to go through all that. So again, to pick out the few important things and have your family member come up with one or two things, you know, keep the list finite, but definitive. These are important. And then make sure you have a way to get back later, because you may think of questions later. So when you end the encounter, how do I reach you with a question? Is it through the MyChart message? Is it through calling the nurse at the bedside thing? How do we get back if we think of a question later? And if they don't have a system, that's the wrong doctor for you. The system has to have something in place to do that. It is tough. And if you're the family member, you know, taking notes certainly helps, you know, writing things down and asking questions. But again, you know, keep it to a small number. You know, 50 questions won't work, but a small number, but insist on that. You know, I really need to know about this medication or why this is here or the referral to ENT. That's the most important thing for me. And don't be shy about saying that.
And what about your perspective on that as a physician, when the patient arrives with a list and a stack of records? Is it general knowledge among doctors that it's their responsibility to be sure that this conversation is clear and clearly understood? Or how do you cope with that when you get the list of 50 things?
Well, so the same thing. So I say, hey, I'm so glad you took the effort to bring these 50 pounds of records and 50 questions. But again, we can't go through them all. That's the reality. So let's pick three things to address today. You pick two and I'll pick one or something like that. You pick your two most important, I'll pick my most important. So we get to that. You know, I'm not going to be able to read through 50 pages of records, but you can pull out the important ones. Or we have to schedule another visit just to look at the records, because it's not realistic to do that. But I do try to put boundaries on what we can do and emphasize what's the most important. And then we either meet another time, we'll follow up on an email message, some other way of getting, to most of them.
That sounds exceptionally good at both preserving the patient's autonomy, I would say, or not, I don't know if autonomy is the right word, but the patient feeling like they've been heard and they have some control over how and when their information will be reviewed, but also in preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Because when things go sideways and either side gets really frustrated with what's going on, that can be a huge issue, as you've also talked about in your book. Talk a little bit about the importance of the doctor-patient relationship itself in establishing effective communication.
Well, the whole thing is a relationship. I mean, obviously, we could have our entire healthcare, taken care of by our computers, right? Our smartphone or an algorithm or AI, right? That's doable. And in fact, that could be accurate a fair amount of the time. I certainly can't remember all the 20 kinds of vasculitis. I'll look them up on UpToDate or Hippocrates. So there's a great role. But imagine what that feels like. You go in with pneumonia. And, a computer looks you over and spits out the right antibiotic, and it could be correct, and you might be cured. Would you actually feel healed and cared for? I think those are two different things, and we need both. And so patients can walk out of our offices and our wards and be cured, but not feel healed in the same way. And that's where the relationship comes in. From a strictly, utilitarian or self-preservation, I think we know intuitively, and there's probably data to back it up, that the stronger your relationship, the less likely you are to get sued, right? Errors happen. Patients know it. And if they feel that you're being straightforward with them and they have a trust, they're more willing to acknowledge that and not drag it out to court. There's a great study. It's an anecdote study where a scenario study where they gave patients different scenarios of medical errors and how forthcoming the doctor was with the error and how likely they were to keep the patient afterward. And the truth is the doctors who told the patient of the error, they wouldn't have known otherwise. The doctor's patients are more likely to keep them, less likely to fire them because they say, well, at least I know they're honest, right? I can trust them because they told me. And so I try to remember that. And the last thing I'll add, and this relates a bit back to your earlier point about establishing that initial communication, is I try to let the patient talk uninterrupted for the first minute. Study upon study shows that we interrupt patients in 8, 10, 12 seconds, some ridiculously short amount of time. And not because we're trying to be rude. We want to know the answer. The patient says, I got this pain here. We jump right in. Oh, when did it start? When it stopped? What makes it better? What makes it worse? Yada, yada. Because we want the answer. But the patient might have also been saying, well, and I also think I had a stroke last weekend. We'll miss that, right? And you can see there's where diagnostic error comes into play. And there was a great study, because I often wondered, how long would a patient talk if you didn't cut them off? Like, could they talk forever? Your Italian patients, your Jewish patients will talk on forever. And I found one study that actually did that. It was a Swiss study that looked at doctors and patients, and the doctors said, how can I help you? And didn't say a word till the patient naturally came to end. How long did they talk? An average of 92 seconds, right? Not the tsunami we all fear, but the Swiss, reserved, precise, diplomatic, but okay, not the same with Americans who have that, the gab gene. I'll try that in my own office. So I tried it out, so first patient I said, how can I help you? Turn the stopwatch. It was like 30 seconds. That's interesting, but they weren't that sick. Next patient, 36 seconds. Next patient, 39 seconds. It was really amazing that patients didn't talk that long. But then I had my the kicker, the patient who has 1,000 psychosomatic issues and real medical issues, psychological medical issues, stresses, and thought, God, if I let her talk uninterrupted, we'll be here forever. But I did. What was interesting is she talked forever. In the end, she came to the end of her, which I had to say, it was only 4 minutes. It felt like 27 hours, but it wasn't. And so one of the lessons that patients will not talk forever. They may talk for a few minutes, but they'll naturally come to an end. And I couldn't solve all of her problems. But she said something that I've read about, but never heard a patient actually say. And she said, just talking about it has made me feel better. And I realized that patients like her are used to doctors putting up walls and turning off the spigot as quickly as possible. And they rarely have the chance to just get it all out. And so I advise my students and my residents, let the patient talk uninterrupted, even for a minute. And that's money in the bank for your relationship. And then you could say, I don't want to cut you off, but we only have 20 minutes. I want to make sure we get to everything. You've told me great information. I'm going to take notes on the computer. Hope you don't mind. But for the first minute, I just look at them. And then we go on, and most patients will understand that. And the patients for whom I've had issues of medical errors, the ones for whom I've had a good relationship with, it goes much more smoothly. And the patients for whom we have a contentious relationship, they're much more likely to threaten to get a lawyer and sue, and you know, they don't have a way to deal with the frustration, even when the error wasn't an intentional thing. You know, there's an explanation for it, but without that relationship, it's really hard to be resilient.
Next, Duncan Embry, a lawyer from Neinstein Personal Injury Law Firm in Toronto, joined us in season two to discuss the legal obstacles involved with litigating the case known as Florence versus Benzequin. The details in this case revolved around a 26-year-old woman who, after being prescribed fertility drugs, gave birth to premature triplets, all of whom sustained serious birth injuries. The complexities of this case raise the important question of whether a physician could be held accountable for negligence that occurred before conception towards the future child. His advice for healthcare providers to have the courage to look at their mistakes and make sure they don't happen again is invaluable. What's the most important thing you'd like doctors to know about medical malpractice law?
That's a great question. The thing I'd want them most to know, and hopefully they all do know, is most of the errors that lead to these cases are preventable. And with the forethought and looking at things and learning from our mistakes and realizing what we can do better, we can prevent harm. We can prevent these cases from ever arising. We can prevent people from suffering the significant injuries they do. Not always, of course, but a lot of what I see on a day-to-day basis, I have to tell you, Chris, it's the same errors that get repeated over and over again. And I think all of us having the ability to step back and the insight and the courage to look at what we've done or what others have done and say, what can we do to make sure that this doesn't happen again? And I think if we all took those steps, we'd all be better for it.
Great answer. I appreciate that you tossed courage in the mix, because that's certainly a big component of what it takes, courage to look at yourself in other cases. How would you answer that question for nurses? Would it be different if I said, what do you want nurses to know about medical malpractice?
No, although I repeat that word a lot of times. I think a lot of times it is about courage. It's about understanding that, and I've of course, examined lots of nurses. I've seen lots of things happen. And I can't tell you the number of times I can tell just from looking at the records that a nurse understood what was happening or what might happen. And there was still a failure of communication and it still happened. And of course, I've never walked a mile in your shoes. I don't know that side of the equation near as well as you or any other nurse who's in the hospital day to day in the trenches. But having the courage to step up and say, wait a second, this shouldn't be happening right now. And the number of errors that are communication based, when you actually boil it right down, it was either a miscommunication or a failure to communicate between two or more people and most errors that I see, I got to be frank, they're not the result of one person making some egregious negligent error. It's the Swiss cheese model of fault, right? It took five or seven events all coming together in some weird way to create this loss. But each of those seven events, if someone stood back and said, wait, hang on a minute, power pause, let's think about this. It's one of the reasons, of course, that we instituted power pauses before surgeries, right? People realized you have to have that level of communication and that step back to say, what are we doing? Are we sure? Well, let's adopt and adapt that to every walk of life and we'd be better off. So in my mind, nurses nurses are the eyes and ears. They see a lot of stuff, and man, they know a lot of stuff. And I have the utmost respect for all of the nurses I've come in contact with over the last 30 years of my practice in terms of their knowledge base and understanding and care of the patients that they're charged with the care for. But it's about stepping up and saying, no, hang on a second, let's look at this again. Did you see my nursing note? Do you understand what the vital signs were or what have you? I think that would change things dramatically.
That's another great answer. And I think you're right on communication. Like statistically, 70%+ of medical errors have an element of miscommunication, wrong communication, late communication, minimal communication attached to them. So well said. What advice do you have to offer for the general public? What would you like the public to know about malpractice?
Ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Because again, when we talk about communication, that also is a two-way street. The patient or their family can really change the level of safety by asking those questions, making sure, like, you know, did you mean to change my medication? Did you, you know, and a lot of times I think people are afraid to ask questions of their doctors. And I know doctors are busy and nurses are busy. Lord knows, especially now, the system is stretched to its limit. But taking that time can save so much heartache. And it can be done in a respectful and a patient way. And I think if people really took that to heart and said, you know, I want to understand my medical condition. I have questions, please help me. That would go a long way. And I guess the other thing I'd say is, I think a lot of people approach the system from a place of lack of familiarity and lack of understanding. And I know I see a lot of cases, a great number of cases, where English is a second language to my clients. And empowering them, and I know most hospitals, not all of them, have translator policies in place, but it can be very difficult to have an interpreter present for each discussion. And I know lots of people feel, boy, my English isn't very good. I better just nod my head and smile. And no, speak up. And if you don't understand, tell somebody.
Those are two great pieces of advice as well. As a nurse, even, I'm always in awe when I walk into a room and I'll hand a patient a handful of pills and they just take them. I would never do that in 1,000 years. I would pick every single thing apart and ask questions about everyone. And my family still gets me about that. If they say, here, taste this, even if it's a bite of their spaghetti, like, there's no way I'm going to put that in my mouth until I've had a good look at it to be sure I know what it is. So that's your specific example about asking about medications is a great one. And I don't know a nurse who hasn't made a medication error. I don't know a single nurse who hadn't made a medication error. So I certainly would have appreciated that moment if someone said to me, hey, what are you doing there? What are you giving me? I would have appreciated that as a nurse. Like, please ask me if it seems wrong. So that's good. And what would you like? You're at the top of your game at this point in your career, Duncan. What would you like other lawyers, maybe upstarts or up and coming or people who dabble a bit in malpractice, what would you like other lawyers to know about medical malpractice law?
Make sure that you do your homework and understand the underlying medicine involved in the situation. Understand it completely before you run off and start a claim or tell a family what you can do for them, because there is nothing worse than putting someone or their family through 3, 4, 5 years of litigation where it shouldn't exist. And, sometimes terrible events happen to people in the medical system, just like terrible events happen to people in other systems. And it doesn't mean that someone fell below the standard of care. And it doesn't mean that there's a viable basis to seek compensation for it. So it's, I get asked to look at a lot of cases. I get asked to take over a lot of cases where someone has erroneously thought that because an injury occurred in the hospital, therefore someone must have screwed up. Not the case. So I think understanding that and really approaching things, listen to what your clients have to tell you, review the medicals, but understand the medicine. And if you don't, make sure you find people who truly do in terms of experts. I mean, and I know you've done podcasts with others before who talk about the expert selection process. I'm a big believer in I don't hire people who agree with me or tell me what I want to hear or tell me I have a case. I'm not interested in an echo chamber. What I'm interested in is someone who spends their life doing this medicine, whatever it may be, in the trenches at the top of their game, who can give me an honest, objective, neutral, and impartial opinion about whether or not this injury was preventable. If the answer is yes, I will go to the end for my clients. If the answer is no, they should know that as soon as possible so that they can move on with their life without false hope, without anything else. Because this process it's invasive, it's costly, it takes everything from a family, but also from the physicians and nurses on the other side. It's a heck of a thing when you go out and make allegations against someone that they've fallen below the standard of care. And I don't take that lightly. And I think making sure that that's done ahead of time and with a full understanding is critical to what we do.
In 2022, Richard Halpern, an experienced plaintiff's lawyer and a returning guest from Gluckstein's law firm in Toronto, delivered an exceptional episode focused on assessment errors in healthcare. He presented the details of a tragic case involving maternal death from a postpartum hemorrhage. During our conversation, I inquired about his thoughts on how healthcare professionals can prevent assessment errors from happening. Among his recommendations, he proposed the development of guidelines that improve patient care and decrease mortality without any regard at all for the potential of litigation. He also expressed a desire for hospitals to view medical errors as opportunity for learning and growth, and reminded healthcare providers to never, ever get complacent. How do we educate healthcare professionals in a way that errors around assessment stop happening? We all know that they do happen, and we often know why they happen, but how do we make them stop happening?
Well, we don't have a central repository for data on these things. Hospitals track their own data, and I suppose there are organizations that track data as well, and we don't really have a measure of the extent of the problem. Whenever I speak to nursing and physician groups, even though I only act for the plaintiff and I make a healthy living off their errors, I try to help them with avoiding those errors.
I know you do.
I like to say that more importantly than making a living off their errors, I am a consumer of healthcare and I would like it to be better. I would like there to be fewer errors. And if I had zero cases, I'd be a very happy guy. So, you know, I've often talked about ways that you can avoid seeing me on the other side of the table in some of these cases. And I wish that hospitals would take these errors and maybe, get people to use them as a learning experience. One of the things that I really don't like about the medical profession's approach to errors is their fear of this shame and blame culture that they talk about. Well, we don't want to. We want to avoid a culture of shame and blame. That's a bad idea to my idea. You shouldn't avoid a culture of shame and blame. You should be. It's about accountability to your patients. There needs to be accountability. And where error is made, you need to face up to the error, acknowledge the error is made, and talk about the corrections you're going to make. And the burden of loss should not be on the patient upon whom you committed the error, but upon you. That's just the nature of what I think is a good functioning tort system. So this fear of shame and blame, I think, results in the profession suppressing responses to errors. I think they still get hidden. In this day and age where you're supposed to be upfront and disclose to patients what's happened to them, I think the opposite is happening. I don't think there's disclosure. When a young parent comes in, two young parents come in to see me about what happened to their baby because their baby has cerebral palsy now when they come in to see me, what's the first question you think they ask me when they come in through the door? What happened to my baby? They don't know. They don't know what happened to their baby. What happened to my baby and why? Shouldn't they know by the time they see me? They don't. They don't. What happened to my baby? And so my first task is to explain what happened to their baby, an explanation that they never got from their medical providers. So I don't think that healthcare as a whole is really facing these challenges head on. I think that there are ways to lower morbidity and mortality in healthcare beyond what's been done so far. And as I said, there are guidelines, I think, that don't help to lower. I think they do the opposite. They help to avoid liability. We ought not to be devising guidelines aimed at avoiding liability. We'd have to devise guidelines that enhance care and that reduce morbidity and mortality without regard to litigation.
Next up, Paul Cahill, a returning guest from 2022, tackled the tough subject of medication errors. He shared numerous cases from his own professional practice where nurses, doctors, or pharmacists had administered the wrong drug, the wrong dose at the right time, or even to the wrong patient. His episode provides valuable guidance for healthcare professionals and the general public on preventing medication errors. Also, Paul provided insights for lawyers on handling these tough cases. And he emphasized to healthcare providers the importance of taking responsibility and admitting to errors when they occur. In your view, what is the most important thing that doctors and nurses need to know about medical malpractice lawsuits that involve medication errors?
You know, one of the things that I always would like to tell nurses and doctors, and I don't get to because I don't represent them. I'm always on the wrong side of the table of nurses and doctors, unless they're doing consultations for me. And that is that it's not personal, you know, strictly from a legal perspective. Mistakes happen, and it's best to just own up to them. You know, if a mistake happens, you know, what frustrates me as a lawyer is not that a mistake happened or someone gave the wrong drug to someone and someone had a bad outcome. What frustrates me is trying to get away with it, or trying to like say, oh, well, that person would have died anyways, or they're old, or, you know, that drug that probably caused it didn't necessarily cause it. It's probably some other drug. You know, I think it's taking, you know, responsibility and accountability for it, because from the patient's perspective, by and large, it's really just about getting some recognition of wrongdoing. It's about getting some closure to a bad event. And it's about getting compensation for losses that they've suffered. It's not about saying, you know, that's a bad doctor, or that's a bad nurse, and they should be punished. And all the time I've done it, it's very rare that I have a vindictive or angry patient, client. And a lot of the times they're just let down and they feel bad, and they just want some recognition. And what makes it worse is, you know, the overly vigorous defense. And I'm not saying that doctors and nurses shouldn't be defended. They absolutely should be defended, just like anybody else should. But at the end of the day, I think having a more pragmatic and holistic approach to things and saying, hey, you know what, something went wrong here, let's try to, you know, fix the broken person, fix a broken system, and let's not, you know, dwell on the mistakes that people made, and just say, you know, mistakes happen, and let's move on.
Good answer. Good answer, Paul. What about to other lawyers who are litigating medication error cases? It sounds like you've done a few. Any advice for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think be careful and don't just assume that because there was a medication administration error that, you know, necessarily it's going to be a, you know, walk in the park in terms of getting compensation for your client. Kind of part and parcel to my previous answer, they do, you know, fight these cases, and it's not, you know, just the nurses and doctors, it's their insurance companies or their, you know, defense associations or whatever it may be. They'll defend the cases. And if at the end of the day, it was one of those cases where there was, you know, a problem with the drug being administered when it shouldn't have been, but the harm isn't really all there. Yeah, those are going to be hard cases, and they're going to fight, and it might not be economical, and it might be challenging. So be prepared that when you do take on these cases, you may need to retain all the right experts, the right doctors, nurses, pharmacologists, whatever you might need to prove the case, because it doesn't, you know, just because it happened doesn't necessarily translate into a viable lawsuit.
Yeah, good one. And what about to the general public? What would you like to know, like them to know about the malpractice lawsuits that are based on a medication error?
Probably that you're better off not having to ever contact a lawyer for medical.
Yes.
You know, the best thing is, you know, to be vigilant, like you said at the beginning, you know, people don't assume that, you know, just because someone's giving you a drug in the hospital, that it's the right drug. And you don't want to be questioning and challenging your doctors and nurses all the time and being a pain in the butt to them, because that's not good either. But I think you need to be alive to the fact that, you know, like, oh, what is this? And what's this for? And why am I taking it? What's that drug called? I mean, we all have phones on us, basically walking encyclopedias. Look it up. You're in the hospital. You're not doing anything anyways. Read about the drugs you're taking. Learn a little bit more about them. You know, it's something you can do yourself. And who knows? It might prevent something bad from happening. And you know, we say, you know, hospitals are dangerous places. They're not terribly dangerous, but you know, you do have to be concerned and pay attention. So that's what I'd say to patients is just pay attention.
In the episode titled "The Medical Malpractice Lawyer Has Another Baby," Maya Tamjanovic not only shares her childbirth experience, in which I am very proud to say I played a tiny little role, but she also imparts the valuable lesson she gained from the less than ideal delivery of her first child. Maya shares the perspective that many potential malpractice lawsuits are attributed to patients feeling unheard, and offers some straightforward advice for healthcare providers discussing experiences with their patients. Her advice? Just ask the question, do you have any questions about what happened? In your view, what is the most important thing that you'd like doctors, nurses, and or healthcare providers to know about medical malpractice law?
I think that for most people, and certainly any of us who practice in this area of law, but even for individual plaintiffs, it's not something that's entered into lightly. And it's, you know, it's either the result of need, that somebody's injuries are so catastrophic and there seems to have been negligence there, and this is, you know, the only avenue to pursue in order to be able to provide a reasonable standard of living and care that isn't necessary. You know, realistically, I know there's always cases that are pursued that may seem to have little merit, but I think a lot of it stems from patients who aren't feeling like they've been hurt. The number of times, you know, we've been contacted by people and they don't want to sue specific providers because that doctor was so nice, or, you know, that nurse really listened to me and really cared, even if, frankly, there's evidence of negligence on those individuals' behalfs. So, you know, I think one way to avoid medical malpractice lawsuits for medical providers is to really listen to patients and show that they're listening. Not only do I think that would avoid many mistakes that happen, but it improves the relationship between patients and healthcare.
You know, I just had a conversation like that with a doctor yesterday, believe it or not, because, you know, I'm not a malpractice lawyer, but I have, like, my medical legal stuff scares people all the time. And so I would just say to him, like, listen, I could be your best friend. You don't need to be scared of me at all. Like, I do not, you know, I am here to help and teach and help everyone understand and just do better. You know, and he said exactly that to me. What we were told is that if our patients like us, if we're just nice, that they won't sue us. And I said, there's an absolute element of truth to that, without a doubt. There's been some interesting research done by a health researcher in the United States, and I can't recall her name right now, but she played audio tapes of doctor-patient conversation, even with the words blurred out. It was just tone and timing of the back and forth between the two people talking. And the general public was able to predict with a 90% accuracy rate who got sued or who would get sued. So there is no doubt an element of people don't like to sue people that they like. But I so appreciate what you just said. Sometimes you've got a child who's got a lifetime of care and is going to far outlive the parents. And it's just the financial need of how do you care for that child for the rest of their life, you know, without handing them over to a social system, which in some places doesn't even exist, right? The social support systems aren't there. So I think that's a really beautiful piece of advice that you can be as nice as you want, but you need to also meet the standard of care and not cause harm.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. There's some people that I have that conversation with and I am encouraging them to put their personal feelings aside because, you know, there is something that needs to be investigated there. But yeah, certainly a huge element. And I think a lot of the times that we get calls where a lawsuit perhaps isn't warranted, either because there doesn't appear to be a breach of the standard of care, but rather just poor bedside manner, or, you know, the damages aren't there for whatever reason, but people are upset and angry because of the way they were treated. And, you know, it can lead to a lot of college complaints, AHS complaints, for example, or complaints to the specific healthcare body. And, you know, that could be avoided with just some care.
Well, great advice for doctors and nurses. Why don't you answer that same question for patients? Patients, and let's just say patients in the general public, what would you like them to know, the most important thing that they need to know about medical malpractice lawsuits?
That there cannot be an expectation that physicians and healthcare providers as people can be perfect and can avoid all bad outcomes, that not every bad outcome is a result of someone's negligence. And, you know, I think people want answers right away. And oftentimes will put me as a lawyer and not a medical expert on the spot wanting an answer as to, you know, whether they were negligent. And we always indicate for the cases that we are prepared to investigate that we'll have to rely on the opinions of medical experts that we trust on whether there was a breach of the standard of care and whether that caused the injury. And, you know, we always say that we hope for the cases we investigate that at the very least we can provide some answers. And for a lot of people, that is really what they want. But there are some people who are just so focused and, you know, have blinders on as to any non-malicious, non-negligent cause of the outcome, that they just won't accept whatever they're told, regardless of the extent of the investigation.
Got it. Yeah, I've been part of some lawyers, some situations like that. It feels like maybe that some of that advice was really good for doctors and nurses too. I want to just go back to that audience again for a sec, because what you said about patients, you're not the first plaintiff's malpractice lawyer who has said exactly what you said, is that the first thing they ask is, I just don't know what happened. What advice would you have to healthcare providers after something happens? And it's not always, I mean, the healthcare provider's definition of a bad outcome and sometimes the patient and or family's definition of a bad outcome are about 1,000 miles apart from each other. But regardless of what it is, to, you know, what advice do you have for healthcare providers when a patient speaks up and said, I don't like this. I don't understand this. I'm not happy about how this turned out. How could healthcare providers better handle that situation to avoid? And I think the bulk of what comes to you are people who don't have legitimate cases, right? But they just have a lot of questions and anger and disappointment and mistrust or whatever the situation is. How could doctors and nurses handle that better?
I'd say it's just, again, being willing to give information, you know, debriefing with a patient, whether they ask for it or not, perhaps before they leave the hospital as to what happened. That was certainly my biggest frustration with my first labor and delivery, is, you know, feeling like I had lost the opportunity to ask those questions, because after all of that, I wasn't really focused on those questions in the day or two that I was still admitted afterwards. And I didn't ask. And then feeling like after, there's no way to figure this out, you know, unless, for example, I wanted to file a complaint, which I did not want to do. But I think if the patient asks those questions, wants some information, providing them with answers and allowing for that process to happen where there can be an open conversation about it. But even in situations where the patient's not specifically asking, you know, opening up the opportunity, because I do feel prior to being discharged, if they had come to do my assessment and, you know, said, do you have any questions about what happened? I would have asked. It just wasn't in my mind right at that moment. I was focused on wanting to get home and have a shower, as I think anybody who's spent more than a day or two in labor and delivery and postpartum wants. So, just being open to that conversation. And I think it is more difficult when there is a bad outcome, because I know certainly, you know, for many medical providers, they will have the thought of potentially a lawsuit on their mind. But, you know, I think you still have to be open to providing the facts.
That's good. And I really like that you've actually just handed out the words there. Like, do you have any questions about what happened? That question right there, I think, is really powerful. So moving back to what you were just saying to the public, I think it's a good source of education. It certainly was for me when I started learning about malpractice. What defines a valid malpractice lawsuit? Because it isn't, I'm mad, my dinner was late, and I know I don't want to trivialize anybody's experience, but from your perspective, what defines a lawsuit with merit, medical malpractice?
Well, it's difficult. Whether there's merit depends on whether you can prove or likely prove that there was a breach of the standard of care, so the medical provider didn't do what they should have done, and that breach caused an injury. And that is often a disconnect that people have, is, you know, something can go wrong, but if there's no injury, damage, bad outcome resulting from it, then there's really no lawsuit, because all you can attain through a lawsuit are financial damages. And those damages are based on the extent of the injury and the losses resulting. So, you know, near misses, I almost died, but am fine. You know, those are situations where we say that, you know, while I understand your frustration or concern with what happened, there would not be a valid lawsuit there. The more difficult part comes in cases where there is merit and there are damages, but the damages are limited. Those are the tough conversations, because the reality is, in our system, and I think in most systems, the financial damages have to be enough to justify the cost and expense and risk of pursuing the lawsuit. So, you know, we always have to look at that balance and determine whether, from our perspective, as, you know, we're obviously lawyers, we seek justice, but the reality is we're also a business and we can't just pursue every case we want to pursue without considering the financial viability of it. And similarly, I always say for the individual or the family as well, you know, you don't want to take on potential financial load, the risk of pursuing the lawsuit, and then losing if that risk is significant and the potential outcome is not significant.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I think that's some version of what every malpractice lawyer I've ever spoken to has had to say about that issue. You know, sometimes it's a little bit different, but I think it's something a lot of people don't understand. You know, it's don't understand, and nurses and doctors don't understand. So the last audience I'd like you to answer that question for, I mean, you're in a fairly elite, I would say, lane of law, being a, you know, an experienced malpractice lawyer at this point in your career, and especially one that does a lot of focus on birth injury cases. That's a very tight niche that requires a lot of expertise, and I always think a lot of courage and other things. What advice would you have for lawyers and attorneys listening in about perhaps doing or getting into medical malpractice law?
That it's not something you can just take on or throw yourself into without having the experience or without having proper mentorship. You know, certainly I've been lucky to have mentorship both from within our firm and outside of our firm from very senior experienced litigators in this area. And, you know, even at this point in my career, I feel that I have a pretty good handle, especially on the birth injury cases that I've had you know, more experience in running those cases to the end, but, you know, it's still something that is so involved and requires such expertise that, you know, we will always run them as a team. And at times where it's a very complicated situation, you know, involve external lawyers as well to get involved. So you hear of cases, or sometimes people will contact us, or even other lawyers will contact us because they've been retained, or from the individual's perspective, they've retained a lawyer to act on a file. They've started running it and now they're getting ready for questioning and realize they have no idea what they're doing. Questioning a doctor is not very easy. You know, it's certainly can be very intimidating. And if you don't have the experience and haven't put in the time to really understand the medicine, you are going to crash and burn. So yeah, I'd say it's not something to dabble in. It's something that you need to be focused on and have the resources to be able to pursue.
Now, last but certainly not least, in the final episode of season 2, Leilani Schweitzer shared the story of the tragic loss of her 20-month-old son, Gabriel, due to a series of medical errors. The account of Gabriel's passing is truly heart-wrenching, but her narrative of how transparency, compassion, and truth can facilitate healing in the aftermath of medical mistakes is invaluable. A particularly memorable quote from that episode was, "Pretending a bad thing didn't happen will not make it go away. It's likely to make it worse." I highly recommend also that you take 15 minutes to listen to Leilani's TEDx talk titled "Transparency, Compassion, and Truth in Medical Errors." You'll be so glad you did. In your view, what is the most important thing healthcare providers need to know about medical errors and dealing with their fallout? And you can lump nurses in that group if you want to. If it's all healthcare providers and you've got the same thing to say, feel free to.
Yeah, I think I would say the same thing. Doing nothing, saying nothing does nothing good. Pretending a bad thing didn't happen does not make it go away. It likely is going to make it worse. I think if there's not a policy or an infrastructure to help you at your hospital, I think it would be good to try to get one, because I mean, the statistics about errors happening, it's just staggering. It's absolutely staggering. And hopefully the things that most people experience are really quite minor, but there's always a chance that it won't be. So I think not coming forward and talking about what happened is not a good thing. It doesn't, you know, how would you want to be treated? How would you want your family member to be treated if they were on the receiving end of that, or yourself? I think most of us would want to understand what happened to us.
Yeah, I agree. Good point. Answer that question for the public. What do you think the public needs to know about medical errors and dealing with the fallout?
I think it would be good if they understood how frequent they are. Most lay people, you know, the civilians who don't work in healthcare, don't even know what the words patient safety means. It just doesn't even dawn on them that they won't be safe when they go into the hospital. I think that having them understand how important that work is and how vulnerable we all are is important. We all have a role to play in it. We're all responsible for each other. And I think that would be helpful. I also think it would be good if patients and families had a resource of where they could go after they have experienced an event like this, or they feel that they have experienced an event like this, so that they could understand how the system works and maybe get some guidance on the approach to get the answers that they want. I think that that would be really helpful for people. That seems to be kind of a kept secret, which will drive patients and families to go to attorneys when they don't know how to get those answers. So I think if we could make it a little easier for those discussions, that'd be a really good thing.
excuse me, that's a good point. Because I will say, you know, just because they call an attorney doesn't mean they have a valid case or a case of any merit. And that's kind of interesting too, because attorneys will tell you they get 100 calls a week, and maybe one of them or two of them will be even remotely valid. It's mostly people who are left angry and questioning and upset and without any, and without support and without explanation. So for the lawyers listening in, there's a good, you know, a program like this could help you out too. You know, they spend a lot of time talking to people who don't really have a case, because we all know bad things happen sometimes. It's not the fault of anyone. So answer that same question now for attorneys. What would you like them to know, the most important thing about medical errors and the fallout of it?
I think that there's better ways to take care of patients and families after an error has happened than getting involved in litigation. I think most attorneys want to help patients and families. And there's, you know, there's some cases that I've worked on where the family getting an attorney has been a good thing for everyone. But malpractice litigation does not make people safer in the hospitals. And that is something that should worry all of us. And it's missed opportunities when things just go into litigation and don't move towards understanding what happened more quickly. You know, to your point, Chris, you said sometimes it can take 7 years to implement some changes. You know, lawsuits take that long or longer, and who's benefiting from that? I'm not really sure anybody is really benefiting from that. But I see the missing point there is that it's not making anybody safer.
That's a really good point. And, you know, I just want to talk about when you said nobody's benefiting, nobody's learning from these accidents. A great number of lawsuits settle out of court, and they're often accompanied by a gag order or silencing order. And the lessons from those lawsuits go nowhere. You know, no one talks about them.
I think about non-disclosure issues quite a bit. I didn't sign one with my son, so that gave me an opportunity to do the things that I'm doing now. But we know that so much healing comes from being able to tell our stories. Like, there's psychological studies done of how people who go through traumas being able to tell that story over and over again reduces the pain from it. And so having those NDAs attached to settlements where there is no opportunity for patients and families to move forward and help solve a problem that they know better than anyone else often is an additional pain. You know, I talked to a lot of people, patients who've had bad things happen to them, and they want to work on it. They want to help, but they have the gag orders. And I think that's a big disservice and another missed opportunity to. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Good point. Before we sign off, is there anything else on your mind?
I guess I would say that this work is complicated and challenging, but far from impossible. And really, really worth it. It's really worth the difficulty of sitting with your own pain to help other people understand theirs, and really quite healing. You know, I've had the opportunity to see forgiveness before my eyes of where patients and families have thanked physicians for their explanations and said things like, I don't want you to worry about this anymore. We know that you did the very best thing. And like that is an amazing thing to see. I've seen a look of guilt move off of a mother's face when she has the opportunity to understand that what happened to her child was not her fault. And that kind of connection and healing and a new perspective does not come on our own. We need each other to help find that. And it's worth it, and it's important. And people who are in healthcare, they do hard things every single day. And this might just be another one of them that needs to happen.
Well, that concludes part 3 of the best of Inside Medical Malpractice. I hope you found this episode enjoyable. I hope you gained some knowledge, and I hope you received some valuable advice that will benefit you both now and in the future. There's still so much more for all of us to discover about medical malpractice, so keep listening. Also, thank you so much for being listeners. If you found this podcast interesting, please show your support by liking, subscribing, and leaving a review. And don't forget that in many jurisdictions, nurses, doctors, and lawyers can earn continuing ed credits just by tuning in. You can find the podcast on all the usual platforms, as well as on the Inside Medical Malpractice YouTube channel. If you're a malpractice lawyer in need of a healthcare expert or a healthcare provider interested in medical legal work, check out our newly revised website at www.connectmlx.com. We would love to hear from you, and we've made it easier for you to get in touch. Goodbye, thanks once again, and take good care.